We have, you know, we all know Michelle very well, Senior Vice President, National Lead of Health and Wellness at Hill and Knowlton, and we really look forward to your update from today. Thank you, Michelle.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be with you, even remotely. I hope that you and your families are all safe and well. As I normally do, I thought I'd share some insights and perspectives from Ottawa and leave lots of time for questions. So I'll start at the very sort of broad political landscape. Where do we find ourselves in June, almost 3 months after the country essentially went into lockdown? And politically, we find ourselves in a place where it is not business as usual in Ottawa. It's not business as usual anywhere, but it certainly has impacted Parliament. As most of you, if not all of you know, Parliament is not sitting as usual. It's convening remotely for most of the time. It does have some in-person sittings, but they are infrequent. Committees are meeting, again, virtually, hearing from witnesses and so on, but Parliament committees, all of political and Department Ottawa are really focused on managing the COVID-19 epidemic, the pandemic, and only now beginning to look to recovery. So the government has really been focused on managing through the crisis, most feeling that the beginning of the end of the wave one is here. And so government is just now starting to able to set up industry roundtables and so on to with an eye to recovery and what will follow and what will come next. Politically, you've seen the Liberals truly operating almost with a majority-like approach to governance, maybe not surprising in a crisis situation. In the instances that they've required support for some of their legislation, they have turned equally to the NDP and the Bloc. So they've had the support they need to continue to govern, really in largely unaffected by its minority status. There has been some speculation that you may have seen about a possible fall election, given the recent polling numbers that show the Liberals polling back where they were in 2015 when they won their first majority. I don't put much credence in that. I think short of something substantial that would require the government going back to the electorate, I don't expect that the Liberals, there may be some Liberals that would like to go to the polls, but short of something substantive, I can't see them returning to the polls less than a year or a year from the last election. I just think voters would really punish the Liberals and see that as a cynical move. So I don't expect, I think we'll hear lots of rumors and speculation, but I would be very surprised if we were into an election. Some have suggested the government may wait until the winter. Again, I think that probably ignores what most experts are telling us, which is there is likely to be a second wave and how a government could ever justify sending the country to the polls in that instance. Again, just seems far-fetched. So I think you can assume that we will continue on with the minority parliament for the time being, that the Liberals will continue to seek the support they need on an issue-by-issue basis from the opposition parties. We are expecting a budget in the fall. It's certainly something we've been hearing. You may have as well, but we are hearing the government talk is talking internally about tabling a fall budget. And really, that's where we think that time frame is where we expect Parliament to resume a more normal cadence and possibly resume some more in-person meetings. So I think the fall is the earliest that any groups could think about a normal or a quasi-normal engagement of government. It really will be the fall before that happens. And again, a lot of questions about whether Parliament will be able to return. And of course, no one can say definitively because so much of that will depend on what happens with the COVID numbers in the country in the fall. And there's no real way to know that with any certainty. So Parliament certainly is planning for all contingencies. And I think groups like Research Canada and your members should be doing the same. I wanted to touch on a couple of policy issues that I know are important to your members. The first being PMPRB. Some of you will be following that issue very closely. You're aware that the planned implementation date of July 1st has been pushed to January 2021. There will be the next iteration of guidelines issued on June 15th, the week of June 15th, for a 30-day consultation period. I think what's critically important for patient groups, for industry, and so on, is to really see that extension, that delay of implementation, is a key window to influence and perhaps force a reconsideration of some of the more contentious, controversial elements of the proposed changes. So we'll be, of course, watching that closely. And I think that consultation period from mid-June to mid-July will be a critically important one. The other issue I wanted to touch on was PharmaCare. I have received over the past number of weeks a lot of questions about what does this, what does COVID mean to PharmaCare? What will happen now? And I think it's hard to underestimate the impact of COVID across all number of policy initiatives the government had been moving forward, whether it's the inquiry into murdered and missing women, the recommendations there. Again, we see significant delays in some of the policy objectives the Liberals had tabled in the pre-pandemic period. And PharmaCare is in that category, in my view. It's obviously delayed the work. Most of Health Canada, if not all of Health Canada, has been focused on the COVID response. I believe that there will have been very little work done on whether it's the Canadian Drug Agency or a strategy for rare diseases. All of that work has really paused over the past 3 months. So the question is, what now, how forward, and what the next steps might be? Again, the earliest I think we'll have any indication from government would be fall. But I think one of the things to keep in mind is in the pre-pandemic period, one of the biggest issues that was still being debated when it came to PharmaCare was the model that would move forward. And you'll remember a camp that was arguing vociferously for an all-encompassing, universal, federal government as first payer model. And the other model, which came to be termed and coined as fill the gap, where the insurance industry would still play a strong role and so on. Well, you think about the financial position of the country 3 months later, and one has to believe that the fill the gap model is now more attractive to government because they simply are in a financial position they couldn't have imagined themselves to be in 2020. And I don't know that they'll have the fiscal room to even consider a universal model. So I think that's primarily right now how COVID is impacting the PharmaCare trajectory. I think it's more on the model. I think the timing was always going to be slow. But the other thing to keep in mind is PharmaCare was a top political priority because it was seen as a public priority, and that has shifted with COVID. And the emergence of the concerns and the public realization of the crisis of the long-term care sector, it's an open question in my mind whether seniors' health and long-term care specifically could supplant the drive for PharmaCare. Because there's going to have to be, as we all know, significant investments in the long-term care sector. What does that do to PharmaCare? What does it do to the political, you know, drive for PharmaCare? I just think that file faces headwinds in today's reality that it just didn't 3 months ago. So things to keep in mind. The other issues, obviously, when we are thinking about moving forward into recovery period, into what will be a new normal, I think everyone agrees there's no going back. But some of the other issues, obviously, that governments are thinking about investing in, and I don't think there's any way to go back from, is mental health, obviously, has been a huge topic of conversation through the pandemic. Virtual care has exploded, and necessarily so. Governments, you know, will have to continue to invest in our virtual care systems across the country. Data and analytics, you know, again, important to a certain segment of the health system. Now everyone in the country is acutely aware of how important data surveillance is. there's going to have to be more investments in that area as well. And then lastly, of course, all of the provincial health systems facing the challenge of addressing the backlog of specialty care and other care that had to be essentially put into abeyance through the pandemic period. So there's a lot of competition. There's going to be a lot of pressure on a healthcare system that itself has been on the front line of this crisis over the past 3 months. So some of our issues as a research community, we have to think about how to position those in light of a new policy environment and frankly, in light of a new fiscal environment. So with that, I'm going to stop and I welcome any questions you have.
Thank you, Michelle. Lots of time for questions, discussion. Maybe the one that struck me just when we're talking about long-term care, I mean, it really couples with pharmacare to be have a proper long-term care, I guess, policy in place across Canada. So it'd be, one sense, maybe it's more emphasis to get a pharmacare at the same time, because you can't do one, I mean, have a proper long-term care. I mean, pharmacare is a big piece of it, I would have thought.
I think you're right. And of course, you'll recall that one of the elements of moving pharmacare forward, certainly from the NDP perspective, was enshrining pharmacare within the Canada Health Act. You will have seen, may have seen, similar calls now to embed long-term care into the
Canada Health Act. That's what I was thinking of, as those calls. Yes.
So you could, I could not, it would be a difficult task for government to include only one of those things and not both. But again, recognizing that both of those policy commitments come with really large price tag. Again, it underscores to me, I just think universal pharmacare is realistically, pragmatically off the table.
Well, I guess the long-term care is more policy from federal and implemented by provinces. So, I mean, in that sense, I guess there'll be requests for money, but it's not.
Oh, yes. Those have already begun.
Yes.
And realistically, the provinces, the kind of investments required, the provinces don't have that kind of capital. So if there are improvements to be made, the federal government's going to be involved, hopefully from perhaps a national standards point of view.
Absolutely.
Certainly from a funding point of view.
Any other comments?
It's David.
It's Jason.
Go ahead, Jason.
We have Jason.
Thanks, David. Yes, thanks. Just a quick question. Just wondering about public health and the implications this has at the federal level in terms of whether or not this will be kind of a renewed emphasis on and focus on public health. You know, traditionally, it hasn't really got a lot of traction given you're spending money for a future unknown. Do you see that potentially changing in light of what's happened on a truly permanent basis? You know, we've obviously had experiences with SARS and other other sorts of outbreaks in the past, but it doesn't seem that it's really gotten the attention of governments and recognizing that the provincial federal dynamic here, but wonder if there's a leadership opportunity for the federal government to step up to the plate in public health as well.
A great question. Thank you, Jason. I do think by necessity, you're going to see investments in public health over the next 2 years. You know, I think most experts would say this is not, even with the, a vaccine were to come to market, there's the logistical challenge of inoculating on a mass scale like that. So I think inevitably you're going to see attention and investment made in public health. It, in my mind, a live question on how long it lasts. Governments tend to react to emerging threats and crisis, and once they pass, it's hard to maintain that focus. You'll recall, of course, that the public health agency was born out of a public health crisis. I think, and I'm going to choose my words carefully, I think the government understands it has not resourced that agency properly, and that going forward, it will need to be strengthened. I expect that to happen. So I think we will federally certainly see some investments coming to the public health agency and frankly, some structural review of the department and its focus. The other thing that I think is going to change significantly at the federal level, which may not touch your members as much, is procurement. And obviously we've seen that change through the pandemic period. It's another thing I don't think will go back. I think the federal government will play a much larger role in procurement of supplies like PPE. I think we will see stockpiling strategies assume a different importance. And the federal government is going to, I think, play a much stronger role than it has in the past, given that it's now seen that through a crisis period, provincial governments will look to the federal government, whether that was part of the pandemic plan or not. And of course, I'm referring to the national emergency stockpile, which was never meant to supply a nation. It was meant to backfill provinces. But at the provincial level, when stockpiles weren't kept up, of course, it's fallen to the federal government. So I see them playing a much stronger and more activist role on the procurement front as well.
David, and then Rudy.
Oh, Michelle, one thing I think this COVID episode has shown is just how disconnected and dysfunctional our health research sector is in Canada. And, you know, despite everything that David Naylor pointed out very clearly, very little progress has been made in actually integrating, connecting the various parts. So we've seen this haphazard approach from the federal government to try and shore up the various elements. We've had a lack of unified response between Tri-Council. We've had separate packages coming for the private sector, targeted at vaccines or whatever. We've had a separate and disconnected response for hospital-based research. The charities, which are an integral part of the system, are suffering and asking for yet another assistance package, rather than the ideal, which is we would have an ecosystem of connected parts, and government would invest a sum of money, and then that would be appropriately distributed to deal with the major elements of the crisis and how that sector could make a difference. Do you think this is a time to actually push that button again and say it's time to connect the parts?
Great question, David. Listen, if there was any time to engage government about how things should change, it is now. They will be looking at every aspect of the response of how the country was positioned in advance of the pandemic, what they need to change going forward. They need to be looking at those things. They are looking at those things, and they will be examining those issues. What I would say is government's not been very successful either in driving forward that type of change or even identifying a coherent system. And if the community could come to consensus, which I think will be challenging, but a key critical success factor. Without consensus, I'm not sure where it would go. But if you could advance consensus around how to do it better, believe me, this is a government that's looking for solutions. They know that this has been an ad hoc response, and I think arguably they've managed it as best they could. I suspect they don't ever want to find themselves in this position again, and they'll be looking for those kind of solutions. But as I say, key to driving it forward is consensus, because if there's warring opinion about how to move forward, you will have the issue stagnate and perhaps paralyze government.
Thank you.
Rob?
Yeah?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, we have time for two more questions. Go ahead. And then Ryan. And do we have anybody else? Okay. Go ahead, Denise.
Michelle, we've been reading and hearing about the use of artificial intelligence and apps to localize whatever they want to localize. And I use the word whatever consciously. Have you been hearing things about this in Ottawa?
Denis, do you mean like contact tracing and that type of technology?
For the time being, yes.
Okay. Well, of course, yes. There's a lot of discussion in Ottawa about a common approach to, at minimum, contact tracing. Obviously, that conversation has to be balanced with all the privacy considerations. And so it's taking government's very well aware. Suppliers have come forward with technology that would meet the needs of contact tracing. What the government's really struggling with is how to balance that with privacy. So it's a huge debate that's going on. There's also a significant piece of legislation that is set to be updated in the coming year that deals with technology and privacy. So all of those factors are woven in. But what I would say in Ottawa, the conversation seems to focus on the provincial inability to do contact tracing well through, you know, people on a phone doing it sort of manually. And the fact that we can't get away from contact tracing, so how do we do it and balance the rights of Canadians? Not whether we should do it, it's a question of how. So I think you're gonna see that technology move forward. And frankly, I think what we've seen is a hyper acceleration of digital technological solutions to some of the health challenges that we face as a country. And that acceleration, I don't see slowing down after this pandemic period. I think it's going to continue and really mark a huge turning point in our healthcare system, where we're going to increasingly rely on technology, whether it's virtual care, whether it's, you know, apps and tracing. I don't see the systems going back to January of 2020.
Thank you. Ryan, one last question.
Sure. Thank you, Michelle. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Industry Strategy Council that's recently been named. You know, how can we be most effective and influential with that group? What is your sense of their level of influence? What's their remit? And what's their timeline?
Right. So they've been named, and that's what I refer to as a bit of a shift the government's starting to make to recovery. So unlike some of the tables that the government convened very early on in March and April, those were focused on how do we deal with the emerging threat, the pandemic. They've started now to recognize that they have to shift. Although that work is still important, we are still waging, certainly in Quebec and Ontario, trying to get the virus spread under control. The government federally has to turn its mind to recovery. So that table's mandate is really focused on how to kickstart, how do we move our economy into recovery? And it's connected to what the Prime Minister is doing on the international stage. You've seen perhaps him positioning Canada as convening the G7 and others around recovery, a coordinated response. And of course, that's necessary because of the size of our market in comparison to some being so small. So they will rely on that table in, I don't think we should assume it's there just for window dressing. They will bring forward a lot of ideas and frankly give the politicians political cover, that these are experts from industry giving them this advice. So it does give them a layer of political insulation from some opposition critics and so on. In terms of how to influence, having Dr. Niemer as a member of that committee, I think we should not underestimate her importance. I know we have talked about it in the past when they eliminated the ministerial position for science. We talked about her importance. She continues to be a huge influencer. I know certainly Deborah and others have a good relationship with her. So, and I assume that many of you would also have a relationship with the person representing the health and bioscience sector as well. So that's where your voice needs to come to the table, is through both of those representatives. And I really do think, obviously, they have work to draw on from those economic advisory tables that were struck. They've all issued reports. You're not going to see a huge deviation. But what that table is going to start debating is trade-offs. What can be moved forward? At what pace? At what cost? Because the government simply won't be in a position to do it all, or certainly not all at once. And so the issue of trade-offs, I expect to be a major discussion at that table. And that's where those two people will be able to make sure that your voice and position as a community is represented.
Thank you, Michelle. I mean, I think an example of the influence that Mona has is, she talked with many of us back in February, March about the importance of follow-up on COVID patients. On the immune side, and the immunity task force was struck a few weeks later. I mean, that's pretty quick for government to work, for that advice, and hopefully that will continue of having that advice, from seeking that advice and then moving forward at a national level on, you know, more than just pandemic issues?
Yeah, I think for the community, I would certainly take encouragement from the last 3 months that the government has really deferred to researchers, scientists, health leaders in the sector to guide the country's plan. And I expect that will continue because, of course, our economic recovery is tied to how we manage successive waves, but also future public health outbreaks. And I think one of the most important things the government is coming to realize is they won't have another 100 years before there's another novel virus or a new outbreak. But I'll tell you, I first began working on the pandemic preparedness file in 2008, talking to government about the need to be prepared. And quite candidly, it was like talking to them about an asteroid strike. They understood intellectually it was possible. They didn't ever think they'd be in government to see the day. So this has brought home the threat of public health and emerging disease in a way nothing else could. And so there is an opportunity for the community to be talking about what needs to change to protect our citizens in the years to come, because we won't have another 100 years to be ready
on all these issues.
Thanks. It's more, thank you. It's more of a comment, Shailen, and actually to the whole group. So if there is going to be more investment in seniors' health and as part of that long-term care, I think groups like Research Canada can advocate that it be more evidence-based than it has been to date. Part of the challenge we're seeing in long-term care these days is because it's been a very old-school approach. Mm-hmm. Seniors have been segregated, they've been institutionalized, and obviously the infection rate is higher because of that, whereas out there, there's much more of a diverse range of practices with seniors. So hopefully we can play a bit of a role in advocating for more evidence-based approaches in R&D, including using digital technologies to support seniors in their communities.
I think it's a great point. And certainly the government is going to be, federally is going to be looking to experts to inform if they were to move forward on national standards. I think that's where that evidence base will play such a key role.
Good. Thank you, Michelle. It's been always very informative, and we look forward to further discussions shortly or near future on